So this evening I'm going to talk about maybe a slightly unusual subject. I'm going to talk about the history of Buddhism in brief. It's not going to be the full history because there's a lot to be said for 2,500 years. But it's going to be a brief history of Buddhism. And I want to talk about that and to join it up with how we come to understand the Buddhist scriptures as a consequence of that history of Buddhism. And I think for me this has always been very important to actually come to a good understanding of the Buddhist scriptures. How authentic are they? Do we know that they actually come from the Buddha's mouth himself? Have they maybe been distorted over 2,500 years, etc.? And it's important also because the Buddha said that we should investigate things. I'm sure many of you have heard of the famous Buddha's discourse in the Kalama Sutta, where he said that you should actually investigate. You shouldn't accept things just because they are a tradition, just because it's spoken by a particular teacher. But we should investigate these things, and we should only when we know for ourselves that this is good, this is wholesome, this is right, only then should we accept it. And for this reason, it's important to also to ask ourselves, these scriptures that we actually rely on, like the Pali Canon, for example, and all those translations, how accurate are they? And it's fascinating to look at the history of Buddhism because it gives us a good basis, in a sense, for deciding how accurate these scriptures are. And that's why I want to get into this. There's two aspects in particular I want to talk about. One is the spread of how the Dhamma spread through many various sects, many different schools of Buddhism, how it became very diversified, how it went to different parts of the world, particularly different parts of Asia. And also I want to talk about the particular history of the Theravada sect, what happened to Theravada Buddhism. These are almost like two separate histories in a sense. So first of all, just the general history of Buddhism. Usually we say that started off very soon after the Buddha passed away, after the Buddha's Parinibbana. And the big event which in a sense started off Buddhist history after the Buddha's final passing away was the coming together of 500 fully enlightened monks, 500 arahats, to decide on what had been the Buddha's discourses, what the Buddha had taught over the past 45 years, because the Buddha's teaching career lasted for about 45 years. So what these 500 arahats, fully enlightened monks, did, they basically recited what they remembered of the Buddha's discourses, and also what they remembered of the Buddha's teaching on the Vinaya, on the discipline for the monks and nuns in particular. And they recited this, and they came to a conclusion together, what was the essence, the essential part of the Buddha's teachings. This was known later on as the First Buddhist Council. And this then became the core from which all other Buddhist teachings and all other later accumulations actually came from. This First Buddhist Council 3 months after the Buddha passed away. But of course there were many more teachings out there. These 500 monks didn't have the whole of the Buddha's teachings. So the question then arose later on, well, when somebody else comes around and says, well, I've actually heard this particular discourse of the Buddha, then how do you decide whether that should go into the canon or not? How do you decide whether this should become part of the scriptures or not? And the Buddha was very foresightful, because just before he passed away, just before his Parinibbana, and this is all recorded in the famous discourse called the Maha Parinibbana Sutta. This is the discourse on the last year of the Buddha before he passed away. And the Buddha was foresightful because he laid down four great standards to be used basically for deciding what is the word of the Buddha and what is not the word of the Buddha. And these four great standards, the Buddha said, well, if somebody comes to you and they say, I have heard such and such from the word, from the Buddha himself, then what you shall do is you shall not reject that, nor shall you accept that. But what you shall do is put it next to the other teachings you know from the Buddha. And if it fits with those other teachings, then you shall accept it and make it part of the collection of scriptures. If it doesn't fit, you should reject it. And of course, it does not become part of the collection of scriptures. So then after this council of these 500 fully enlightened monks, there was a steady accumulation of discourses as this particular test was being used. And this went on for about 100 years, maybe 150 years after the Buddha. And at this stage, a large accumulation of discourses have come into being. And this is very similar to the discourses we have today. You find it in the library here in Nolamara. There is the section on the Vinaya, on the discipline of the monks. And then there is the suttas, the discourses, which are divided into the four main groupings. The long discourses, the middle-length discourses, the connected discourses, and the numerical discourses. So this is what happened at this stage. But of course, sooner or later, in a large grouping of monks and nuns and lay people, etc., sooner or later you get arguments arising, or at least disagreements arising. What actually is this teaching of the Buddha? And often there are minor points on which people disagree. And when these agreements eventually they came to a head about 150 years after the Buddha, and at this time the first split in the community of monks and nuns happened because of this disagreement. And this, of course, is a very important point in the Buddhist history when this first split happened, because it meant that the Buddhist Sangha was no longer unitary. It was no longer, it didn't work together in the same way it had before. And this split happened approximately maybe 100 years after the Buddha. And once the first split had happened, of course, in a sense that opens the floodgates. Because then people think, okay, splitting is okay, or something like that. And of course, once one split had happened, one happened after the other, and sub-sects and sub-schools from the two original schools came into being one after the other. And about maybe 300 years after the Buddha, there is the standard figure of 18 different schools is mentioned as a number of schools that existed at this time. And very often the points of divergence between the schools were very, very small, were tiny little minute philosophical things. But it was enough, you know, for people to actually disagree sufficiently to form new schools about it. I'm not going to go into detail about what those things, differences were, because it's really a bit beside the point of what I want to talk about there. So among these 18 schools, there were two schools in particular which I would consider particularly important. And they are important not so much because they stood out at that particular time in India, but they are important because to this day they have the most influence on what we take to be Buddhist thinking, Buddhist thought. And these two schools is the Pali scriptures, the Theravada school, and the reason, of course, that it's so influential is because we still have the scriptures of that school almost completely intact from the very early days. And the other school, which has been influential and still is to the present day, is called the Sarvastivadin school. And the reason that this school is so influential is because its teachings are basically recorded in the Chinese scriptures. If you read the Chinese scriptures, there's actually lots of different schools collected there, but the most important one and the most the one which occurs the most there, so to speak, that is from the Sarvastivadins. And these two schools, the Theravadins and the Sarvastivadins, they split apart from each other about 200 years after the Buddha passed away. And the way that the Theravada school came into being, largely, was under the reign of King Ashoka. You may have heard of the King Ashoka. He was the emperor of India about 250 years after the Buddha passed away. And he was an emperor of the entire subcontinent of India. He's one of the most powerful emperors India has ever had, King Ashoka. And he was a Buddhist. He converted to Buddhism. So one of the things he did was he actually sent his son and his daughter. His son was named Mahinda, he was a monk. His daughter was named Sangamitta, and she was a nun. And he sent these two on a missionary trip to Sri Lanka. And when they went to Sri Lanka and they realized that this is the son and the daughter of the King Ashoka, the great emperor, then of course that became very interesting for the Sri Lankans. And very soon thereafter, the king of Sri Lanka became a Buddhist. And this was like the big turning point for this particular sect of Buddhism, which then became later on Theravada. Well, at this stage, it was basically Theravada Buddhism. Soon as the king converts and becomes a Buddhist, then of course that means that the whole island basically is influenced, very heavily influenced by Buddhist thought. And ever since then, Theravada Buddhism has been very powerful in Sri Lanka because of that. It's been existing there for 2,300 years. And many of the most important developments in Theravada Buddhism, such as scriptural developments, etc., have happened precisely in Sri Lanka. But not only did Buddhism spread to Sri Lanka, Buddhism also spread to Burma and to Thailand. And I think the earliest archaeological evidence for Buddhism in Burma is about 300 to 400 years after the Buddha. But Buddhism was still much weaker there than it was in Sri Lanka. So that is the Theravada Buddhism. That's basically how Theravada Buddhism came into being. Now the Sarvastivadins, this other school I was talking about, they had the stronghold in the northwest of India, in present-day Afghanistan and Pakistan, and also the area which is today the northwest of India itself. That's where they had their stronghold. And of course, this is quite close to the Chinese border in China. So when the Chinese came to India and they started to become interested in Buddhism, the school that they came into contact with most was precisely the Sarvastivadin schools. So they brought back the Sarvastivadin scriptures from India, brought them back to China, and translated them into Chinese. And that's why, to this day, the Chinese scriptures are very largely based on the Sarvastivadin schools. As I said before, there's also other schools, but this school is the most important one. And this is all before the rise of Mahayana. These are all the early schools of Buddhism, not Mahayana Buddhism, which later came into being. These are all the early schools, and the teachings of these early schools are extremely similar, almost very much the same, in fact. So what does this mean for our understanding of the scriptures to the present day? Well, what it means is that we have, remember what I said before, that this Theravadin school and the Sarvastivadins, they split apart about 200 years after the Buddha passed away, right? One went to the north of India, and one went to the very south, to Sri Lanka. They were actually quite far apart geographically, these two particular schools. So what it means is that we basically have two schools whose scriptures have been separated for 2,200 years, 2,300 years even. So it therefore becomes very interesting when you start comparing these scriptures, because you get a very strong idea of how well preserved they have been. And I have myself been doing some study in this area, particularly there's a monk who I know reasonably well, a German monk, who does study the comparative study of the Pali and the Chinese. And the most remarkable thing, the most interesting thing which comes out of this particular study that he has done is that these scriptures are in many ways almost identical after 2,300 years. And this is, for me, this is just a remarkable thing, because it gives rise, for me at least, to an enormous amount of faith that what we have today, the scriptures that we have today, basically they are the word of the Buddha. They have almost not changed at all for 2,300 years. We are 200 years away from the Buddha from when these schools came apart. So if they haven't changed for 2,300 years, then surely they wouldn't have changed much in the first 200 years either. And I find this very, for me, this is very, very powerful, because it means that when I read the suttas, I know that what I'm seeing here is pretty much exactly as far as all the important doctrines go, the Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path, the five spiritual faculties, all the gradual training, all these important concepts that we always talk about as practicing Buddhists, all these are there in both of these schools, almost word for word identical after 2,300 years. And it gives a tremendous sense of confidence that when you read this, you're actually reading the word of the Buddha. It gives you this feeling of being in the presence of the Buddha. This is what the Buddha said, and you don't have much doubt about it anymore. I find that an extraordinarily powerful thing to be aware of. And I think that is the most important discovery, as far as I'm concerned, of the comparative research between the various schools. The fact that we know that this, what we have today, pretty much is the word of the Buddha. But there are also other things which come out from this particular study of comparison of these various sources. And because there are also differences, they're not exactly the same. And one of the interesting differences which come out of this particular research is that the beginning of the suttas, the beginning of the discourses, and also the conclusion of the discourses, that is where you find most of the differences in these discourses. So, for example, you know how if you have read the discourses, they often start with things like, at such and such a time, the Buddha was teaching in such and such a place, and he was teaching to so and so, and then he said such and such, and that is like the introduction. And then at the conclusion of the sutta, then maybe somebody says, oh, and then such and such became a lay disciple, or such and such became fully enlightened when he heard this particular discourse. And it's in these areas we actually find large discrepancies between the Chinese and the Pali version, which is quite interesting. Because these are basically, if you like, the historical packaging in the sutta. These are the sort of the additional stuff which is not the core essence of the sutta. And what it basically means is that the Indians at the time, they didn't put a lot of effort into historical accuracy. They weren't really interested in historical accuracy so much. The important thing to the Indians, which have always been, I suppose, a spiritual people, was to actually retain the essence of the doctrine. This was what was important. So the main teaching you find in the discourses, the doctrinal part, the thing which was the Dhamma, the Buddhist content, that was kept almost word for word correctly. But the historical aspects, the places, the people that were involved, all that, that is something which hasn't been kept very well, and therefore is different between the different traditions. And of course, as far as we are concerned, as far as I'm concerned anyway, I think it's great, because what does it really matter where these discourses were spoken? Who was it spoken to? How many people became enlightened? It's really quite, it doesn't matter so much. The important thing is to know that the actual Dhamma, the teachings, have been kept intact and kept well for these 2,500 years. That is what matters. So in a sense, the strange discrepancy there between our modern way of thinking, where historical facts tend to become so important, and the Indian way of thinking, where historical facts really didn't really matter much. Actually, when you're a Buddhist, it's a great boon. You're very happy that they didn't actually put more effort into historical facts and forgot about the spiritual aspects instead. So that is one of the differences. Another difference is that occasionally, when you read the Pali, you come across passages which don't exist in the Chinese. Occasionally come across passages in the Chinese which don't exist in the Pali. And this, of course, is interesting. Particularly interesting is it, I find, when you come across passages which are in the Pali but which don't exist in the Chinese. Because it makes you wonder, why is it that one has them and one does not have them? And the general standard is of course, to assume that what these two collections of discourses have in common, that is the word of the Buddha. What they don't have in common, that is always more suspicious. And there's one particular instance which I came across recently, which I find was very fascinating to me. And this is a discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it had a passage which was very strange. It was strange because it was a passage which I couldn't find anywhere else in all the discourses. It only existed in this particular discourse. And you may know that the Pali Suttas are very repetitive. Central topics occur again and again and again. So when you have one particular thing which never occurs anywhere else, well, it almost like stands out like a sore thumb in a sense. Particularly because this was a very central and important part of this particular discourse. And on closer inspection, I also saw that this particular paragraph, or these particular paragraphs, not only don't they exist anywhere else in the suttas, but they are a verbatim repetition of what is found in another part of the Tipitaka called the Abhidhamma. And now I have to give you a little bit of background on the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is a later compilation of philosophical statements, in a sense, which were done after the Buddha passed away. In fact, the whole Abhidhamma is really a philosophical work which talks about the nature of reality and how reality is composed. It divides mind and matter up into the most minute possible elements, almost like atoms, if you like, atoms of the mind and atoms of the body. And it divides time up into the most shortest possible time capsules. So it's a philosophical work, and it's a work which tries to describe reality as it actually is. So that is the Abhidhamma, and it was composed maybe about 200 or 300, 400 years after the Buddha, over a period of time. Now here is a paragraph which is taken verbatim out of this Abhidhamma, this higher philosophy, and found in the Sutta, and not found anywhere else. So it looks, on the surface of it, it looks suspicious. Does it really belong here? You don't really have anything to compare it with, so you don't know whether it belongs there. You can't tell whether it is true or not. Maybe it is true, maybe it's not. It doesn't look like it belongs there. It doesn't look like it has been there original in the Sutta. And then, of course, you come to the Chinese, and you compare it to the Chinese suttas, to the Chinese discourses. And, of course, what you find that in this Chinese discourse, this paragraph doesn't exist. It's not there. And suddenly you have a confirmation that this thing has much more likely now been a later addition to this particular discourse. So is this important, you may ask? What does this actually mean? Does it really matter all that much? Well, it matters because one of the important things in Buddhism is that we know, we have to assume that the Buddha was enlightened. He is our teacher number one. He is the one who, without him, everything else really falls apart. There wouldn't be any Buddhism without him. So if he wasn't enlightened, then nothing else really works. But everything else which wasn't said by the Buddha, like the Abhidhamma, the commentaries, all kind of later scriptures, we just don't know where they come from. And because we don't know where they come from, we have to be careful how we use them. And we have to set them to one side, put a question mark against them, and we cannot assume that they are as comprehensive and as good and as accurate as the word of the Buddha itself is. So because of that, because we don't know the Abhidhamma, we don't know how accurate and how correct it is, and how well it actually compares with the word of the Buddha, when we find a paragraph in a sutta which seems to have been inserted from the Abhidhamma, then we can put that paragraph to one side and say, we don't know. Maybe it doesn't belong here, maybe it does, but because it might distort the content of the sutta, it's better to put it to one side. So that is a lot of detail, but it's just the idea is just that the point I'm trying to make is just that when we have this great opportunity to compare the discourses between different traditions, suddenly we have material whereby we can actually find out the truth as to how authentic our discourses are in the Pali Canon, how true they are, how far back they go, and how close they are to the word of the Buddha. And the most important thing, as I said, when you start doing this sort of comparative study, that you find, wow, this is incredibly close to the word of the Buddha. Occasionally you find discrepancies, but on all the most important points of the doctrine, we can be almost absolutely sure that what we have today is the word of the Buddha. And that is, I find, extremely important. So that is the very briefly a little bit about the various schools of Buddhism and how that history has affected our present-day research and the various scriptures that we have available to compare with each other. Now I want to talk a little bit about the history of Theravada Buddhism and to see how that affects our reading of the scriptures. So Theravada Buddhism, as such, as I mentioned before, really started out when King Ashoka sent his son and daughter to Sri Lanka and converted the king of Sri Lanka, and most of the Sri Lankan population became Buddhists. And one of the most important documents that were written by this new school was the Theravadan Abhidhamma. This was written very early on, maybe 200 to 400 years after the Buddha, and it became later on considered extremely important in the Theravadan school. In fact, the Abhidhamma became so important in the Theravada school that it almost superseded the discourses of the Buddha himself. And the reason for that is because the Abhidhamma is supposed to be like this complete philosophical systematic exposition of the Dhamma. It's supposed to be the complete thing, whereas the suttas were not supposed to be the complete thing. And of course, over time, what happened was that people forgot that the Abhidhamma had been collected and gathered together after the Buddha. And because they forgot that, they started to take the Abhidhamma itself as the word of the Buddha. So you can imagine what happened. Here you had a philosophical system which was supposed to be complete, which was supposed to be the highest possible expression of the Buddha's Dhamma. It wasn't possible to make it more complete than this. And at the same time, one thought that this actually had been spoken by the Buddha himself. So what happens then? What happens then, of course, is that this Abhidhamma, in fact, gets a position which is extremely high here. It gets put even above the discourses, the early discourse of the Buddha himself, because it is supposed to be the highest expression of the Dhamma, right? So this was one of the early developments in Theravada Buddhism, this coming out of the Abhidhamma. And the Abhidhamma has often been called like the crown jewel, in a sense, of Theravada Buddhism. But that is only if you're really into philosophical matters. So I should also say that one of the important distinctions between the Abhidhamma and the early discourses, and what marks the distinction, that distinction very clearly here, is that the Abhidhamma is a philosophical work. So it is, as I said before, it's a description of reality. It breaks reality up into tiny fragments, both in time and also in terms of matter and mind. So it's an analytical, philosophical study here. It's a description of reality here. The discourses are completely different. The discourses of the Buddha are pragmatic. They are about actually becoming happy, about finding happiness in the world, and about ending suffering. That is the purpose of the discourses. So the purpose of the discourses and the purpose of the Abhidhamma are actually quite different. And this is important to bear in mind. So after the Abhidhamma then had been established and became a key part of Theravada Buddhism, and this part of this probably happened in Sri Lanka, the Theravadan Abhidhamma is quite different from the Abhidhamma of other schools, and this is one way that scholars know that this was a late development after the schools had departed from each other. When Theravada Buddhism then came to Sri Lanka, a second, more literature started to appear. And the second literature which started to appear in the Sri Lanka is what is known as the commentaries. These are the commentaries to the suttas, to the discourses, and also commentaries on the Abhidhamma itself. These commentaries were made up by a very well-known monk called Buddhaghosa in about the 5th century AD. And these commentaries, essentially, the purpose of these commentaries is to explain the discourses of the Buddha and to explain the Abhidhamma. So what they do is they take a phrase in the suttas which may be a little bit obscure, or they take a word which maybe people are not sure about, and then they explain it in one way or another. Now the way that these commentaries go about explaining the suttas and the Abhidhamma is that very often what they do, particularly when it comes to the suttas, they may take a doctrine, something you find in the Abhidhamma, and then they may explain the suttas in terms of this particular Abhidhamma statement. Now remember what I said before was that the Abhidhamma is very different from the suttas, because the Abhidhamma is about describing reality. The suttas is about the practice or the path which leads to liberation from suffering. They're two different things. So when the commentaries take the Abhidhamma and they start explaining the suttas using the Abhidhamma, well, the chances are that you're going to get some distortion there, because there are two very different types of systems with two very different purposes. So that is one reason one has to be very careful. For example, if you take the middle-length sayings from the library over here and you start reading some of those discourses in there, now often if there's something you wonder about, you're not sure about, you will look in one of the notes, right, in the back here, and it will give you some explanation as to what is the meaning of this particular phrase or word. But you should be aware that those notes in the back are very often taken from the commentary here. So when you start reading those notes, you are interpreting those suttas in accordance with the commentary here. And that also means that you will interpret in the suttas in accordance with the Abhidhamma, because that is what the commentaries use to explain the suttas, the discourses, very often. So this is important to be aware of, because that can lead to distortions of the material. So it's very handy to know that. And of course, it didn't stop with that. There was, after the commentaries had been made, there was much more material also written in the Theravada tradition. One of the very important works, which is often cited as also one of the, if you like, crown jewels, if you like, of the Theravada tradition, is the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification. It's this big, almost sometimes called encyclopedia of meditation. This long, long treatise on various aspects of morality and meditation and also wisdom. And it has become extremely important in the Theravada tradition. This was also written by the same monk I mentioned before, this monk called Buddhaghosa. But again, if you start reading that, you realize that even though a lot of it is interesting and a lot of it is good, there's also a lot in there which is based again on the Abhidhamma and the commentaries. So you don't have the certainty, you don't have that same clarity that this actually is the word of the Buddha as you have from the discourses themselves. And then from that you had other commentaries being written, you had commentaries on the Abhidhamma, you had all kind of study manuals for the Vinaya, for the discipline, also for the higher teachings. And even to this present day, you will find scholars in various countries, particularly maybe in Burma, and they are still writing commentaries in Pali on these suttas and on their own commentaries. So it's still happening today. And the very fact that it's still happening today, of course, means that the commentaries throughout the ages have been the product of scholars, of monks who have been sitting around, and it's not something that we have inherited from early Buddhism. So I should maybe say also that what I'm saying now is not that we should necessarily reject the Abhidhamma or reject the commentaries completely as completely wrong or whatever. The point isn't so much that, because to study these things so much that we can say with certainty that everything there is wrong or everything there isn't right is basically an impossible task, because it basically is impossible. So what you have to do instead, and this is the way I usually think regard to these matters, is that, well, we don't know where these things come from. There may be a lot of correct things here, there may be a lot of wrong things here, we just don't know. So because we don't know, you just put a question mark beside it, you put it to one side, and you don't have to decide whether it's right or wrong. You just don't take it as seriously as you would what we can decide with fair certainty is the word of the Buddha. That is what really matters for us as practicing Buddhists. So what this shows us is that we have that in Theravada Buddhism, as in all schools of Buddhism, there has been a long, long development of literature, all based around the original suttas and discourses of the Buddha. But a lot of this later literature, because we don't know where it comes from, we have to be careful with it, and we can't take it as definite truth, or certainly correct in terms of that it actually is compatible with the word of the Buddha. We just don't know. And this is the important thing here. So when you read the suttas, this is one of the things you should always watch out for, always be careful about. So essentially, what I have been trying to say this evening is that there is now so much good material out there, so many ways of looking at the suttas, that we have discovered that we basically know what the word of the Buddha is, and we basically know what is not the word of the Buddha. And because we can distinguish between those two things, we have a great and wonderful resource to come very, very close to what the Buddha actually said. And when you read the suttas in the Pali Canon as they are translated, and even found here today in the library in Rovaniemi, you know that that which you're reading basically is what the Buddha said. That's basically what I wanted to say, but maybe because there's quite a bit of time left, I want to go a little bit back to the history of Buddhism in India again, maybe, because that is a fascinating subject, I find. What actually happened in India? Because I, as I said before, was that there were two most influential schools were Theravada Buddhism, which exists to the present day, and Sarvastivadin school. These were the two most important ones. But what about the rest of the schools in Buddhism? What happened to them? And what happened basically on the Indian continent was that it seems that over time Buddhism became very corrupted for some reason in India. And partly that may have been the development of all sorts of strange practices. But maybe the most important reason why it became corrupted was that it became more and more institutionalized into massive, large monasteries and large universities. You may have heard of the famous Nalanda University in India, which was established maybe about 500 years after the Buddha. And there were thousands and thousands and thousands of monks there. It was extremely hard to get into this university. You had to, when you got to this university, somebody would go up to you and they would ask you a number of very, very difficult questions. And only if you could answer these really abstruse and difficult questions would you actually be allowed into this university, because it was so full already. But what was happening here was that there was more and more emphasis on scholasticism, on debating. There was lots of debates going on. I think the Indians, even to this day, are famous for as lovers of debate. And so it seems they were also in those days. And so there was all this scholasticism going on. And of course, what that meant, that there was less and less emphasis on the practice side of Buddhism. So there was a decline in the actual realization and a true understanding of the Dhamma, as opposed to the scholastic and intellectual understanding of the Dhamma. And this meant that over time, Buddhism became weaker and weaker in India, and Hinduism again began to become by far the most powerful force in Indian society in those days. And then the final sort of blow to Buddhism was, of course, as you may know, the invasion of the Muslims, the Muslim invasions, which happened in the 11th, no, the 12th and the 13th century, I think. And they, the Muslims, they attacked particularly these enormous large institutions of learning, such as the university at Nalanda. And they killed thousands and thousands of monks, and they laid the entire university basically to ruin them. Sometimes it is said that it was the Muslims that came at that time who actually destroyed Buddhism. But I think most modern scholars agree that it wasn't actually so much the Muslims. The Muslims just gave Buddhism the final blow, so to speak, in its homeland. It was actually the corruption of Buddhism already, which had happened over the past 500 or 600 years before that, that really was the major blow to Buddhism in India at the time. So what happens is that all these schools, all these 18 schools, eventually they died out. And they were only kept alive as the Theravada school in Sri Lanka and in Southeast Asia and as the Sarvastivada school in China. Now, of course, we also know that there is much more to history of Buddhism than this, because one of the very important aspects of the history of Buddhism is the rise of Mahayana Buddhism. And Mahayana Buddhism, of course, became very, very powerful later on, particularly in East Asia. And Mahayana Buddhism started to arise in India about around the time of Christ, around the year zero. And it took a very long time, apparently, for Mahayana Buddhism to become a powerful religion, if you like, in Indian society and also in other societies in Asia. It very, very slowly developed. And what is important to know about Mahayana Buddhism is that even though it is based on all these other suttas which arose after the initial suttas had been decided on, even in all Mahayana Buddhist schools, they still have the core of suttas that we also have, the discourse that we have. They still have that core. So there are actually many Mahayana Buddhist schools today around the world who actually say, well, should we really be studying this Mahayana suttas? Maybe we should be going back to the early discourses, which we know with certainty actually is the word of the Buddha. And I know that there are schools in Taiwan, for example, in this day, who say that we should try to strive to go back to the early discourses of the Buddha. And the reason for that, of course, is that the Mahayana suttas are quite different from the other suttas. They are much more elaborate. They are often extremely long. And if you see the Chinese Tipitaka, which contains all these suttas, it's a massive, massive collection with hundreds and hundreds of volumes. This enormous thing here. And when you start to realize that these things arose a long time after the Buddha, well, then you start to wonder, well, how can this really be the word of the Buddha? And this is what some people now are questioning around the world, also in Asia. How can this really be the word of the Buddha? Of course, when you have a tradition that tells you that this is the word of the Buddha, you tend to believe that. And that's what the Chinese, and that's what everybody has believed all these centuries, until modern scholarship has made it very clear that this actually is not the word of the Buddha. And it's the same thing with the Pali canon. Almost all traditional Buddhists have taken the things like the Abhidhamma and the commentaries basically to be the word of the Buddha, until modern scholarship came around and said, actually, with careful analysis, it becomes quite clear that it cannot be the word of the Buddha. And a good thing about all this is that all schools of Buddhism, Mahayana, Theravada, and to some extent also Tibetan Buddhists, have the same core of suttas, which go all the way back to the Buddha. And this is where we can find the common core and a common cause, if you like, together as Buddhists, because we all have this word of the Buddha there if we want to look at it. And sometimes Mahayana Buddhists, sometimes I don't think even they understand or know that they actually have this core of teachings there, exactly the same as we have in Theravada Buddhism. But it's becoming more widely known today here. And that, of course, gives us a possibility of having dialogue and speaking together. And instead of arguing about the Bodhisattva path, or the Arahat path, or jhanas, or whatever else, we can come to some agreement about these basic issues, because there is a core which we have in common. Okay, I think that's all I want to say, actually. Maybe people want to ask some questions or comment or whatever. Yes, yes, so. Yeah.
When I read the Sutta Pitaka, I see the Buddha talking about Dhamma and quite a lot, and Vinaya, and he never ever talks about Buddhism. And he never talks about Buddhists. He sometimes talks about Savakas, like people have heard the Dhamma. And that strikes me as quite interesting. So my question is, what is the origin of the term Buddhism and Buddhist? And also, what are the implications? Should we consider ourselves to be Buddhists, or should we just consider ourselves to be followers or people in search of Dhamma? And the distinction being, rather than being followers of an ideology, but just like being more inclusive, that all people are able to be searching for Dhamma.
Okay, yeah, that's a nice question. So the first part of that question is that the Buddha never talked about Buddhism or Buddhists. When did this word actually originate? And apparently most people say that the word Buddhism originated when Westerners became interested in this particular thing. Yeah? Because it never actually existed before the Westerners became interested in this, which is fascinating here. So in Asia, it has never really been known as Buddhism. It has been known by such things just as Dhamma, or the Buddha Dhamma, or the Dhamma Vinaya. These are all words which basically mean the teachings, or sometimes you hear the word the Sasana, which is like the Buddhist dispensation. But Buddhism has never really been a word which has been used as such. Yes, I think it's important to ask yourself, should we call ourselves Buddhist, or what should we actually call ourselves? It's an important one. I recently read an article by a novice monk, a very senior novice monk, an Australian novice monk, been a monk for 30 years. And he was arguing that, you know, Buddhism is so corrupted everywhere that basically we shouldn't call ourselves Buddhists at all. We should actually start a completely new sect and sort of go back to basics again. That was what he was arguing here. But I think that might be going too far. But I think you have a very important point in saying that, what should we call us? For example, if we come to the Buddhist society here, should we call us Theravada Buddhists? And I think that that generally the word Theravada Buddhism means many different things. But to most in Asia, Theravada Buddhism basically means that you take the Abhidhamma, the commentaries, the Visuddhimagga. You take all of these things as part of your understanding of what Buddhism is all about, right? That is what Theravada Buddhism basically is. You take the suttas as well, of course, but usually in Asia, particular traditional way that things are studied in Asia, you put much more emphasis on reading the Visuddhimagga, reading the Abhidhamma, and reading the commentaries, than you put on actually reading the suttas. The reason for that is because by reading these other things, only that way can you understand what the Buddha said in the suttas. Because according to tradition, it's so difficult to understand what the Buddha said. So I would say that if we're going to call ourselves Theravada Buddhists, well, we have to make it clear that we're not, maybe not Theravada Buddhists. I don't consider myself Theravada Buddhist in that traditional sense, because I take the word of the Buddha basically to be found in the Dvipitaka, not the Tipitaka, the Dvipitaka. The Dvipitaka means the two baskets rather than the three baskets. So I think that sometimes these terms have a lot of baggage to them, so it might actually be better to cancel them altogether and say that I am a follower of the Buddha. I'm neither Theravada Buddhist nor any other type of Buddhist. I'm just a follower of the Buddha. And I know pretty much where I can find the word of that particular Buddha. Huh? So I would agree with you. But I think being a Buddhist is pretty safe, because if you call yourself Buddhist, that might just mean that you're a follower of the Buddha, huh, in a sense. So it really depends, obviously, on what you put into these words and what they actually mean. Are you happy with that answer? Huh? Yeah? Okay. Jean, huh? How old in Hinduism is it? Okay. Well, Hinduism is supposed to be extremely ancient, and it goes obviously back way beyond way before the Buddha. I think the sort of Hinduism that we have today started off with the scriptures known as the Vedas. Now, the Vedas are supposed to have been written about almost up to 1,500 years before the Buddha. That's when they came into being. These Vedas are just basically hymns, these verse hymns, versified hymns. And this is the main scriptural basis for the Vedas. But the actual society that the Vedas come from, that society is supposed originally to have come from the Iranian-Russian steppes, just north of Iran. And then they moved from there down through Iran and into what was known as Greater India. And another part of these immigrants, they went up to Europe. So they sort of split into two streams, one going to Europe, one going down to the Indian subcontinent. And this is that's why we today have the Indo-European languages. All these languages, all the ancient languages of Pali, Sanskrit, and also modern-day languages in India, they're all related to European languages. And this is precisely because of this. It all came from a common source, maybe 6,000 years ago or so. And that is basically the origin of the Vedas. It's very fascinating when you start knowing a little bit of Pali and knowing a little bit of these ancient Indian languages. It's fascinating the closeness of many of these words have to European words. For example, in Pali you have T-I is three. And if you look at all European languages, they all begin with a T in three. If you have chataro, it's like cuatro in Spanish or French, right? And when you start to look at it, you find this enormous number of similarities. You have matar in Pali is mother. Matar, mother. Pitar is father. And there is a relationship there all the way through, basically. See the same roots. Yes. Right. I'm implying that the suttas were spoken to people in India at the time, right? So people were able to understand these discourses at the time in India. Huh? So is there any reason why we today need this enormous amount of interpretive commentaries to actually understand the suttas? Surely there isn't much difference between us and the people at the time of India. We may be richer, we may be better off, but in terms of capacity, intellectual or spiritual, it's probably pretty much the same, I would assume. So I say that because the Buddha taught these suttas to ordinary people at the time of the India, and they understood it, and surely we also don't actually need this massive commentarial literature and Abhidhamma to understand what the Buddha was talking about. Surely we can understand it as it stands on its own. But of course that is a simplification, because some suttas are complicated and difficult. So then what you do, what I think is a more fruitful way, rather than going to the commentaries, you can go to the commentaries, and initially you can get some good understanding from there. It's actually probably more fruitful to go to somebody who has been studying these matters for a long time, and somebody you have confidence in, also has good meditation, as we were just saying now, so they actually know what they're talking about in relation to these scriptures, and ask them what they, how they actually regard this. And you probably get a better answer than, or you may get a better answer. Or they may say, well, in this case, the commentary is right, or the commentary makes sense. You can go for it in this particular case. But generally speaking, because the suttas were spoken to people at the time, they would understand it. So I think we should do it today as well, without relying too much on commentarial Abhidhamma literature. And yes, I think you're right. Of course, the whole point is, the point of these things is to practice, right? The point of the Dhamma is to practice it. And it's when you practice it that a deeper understanding of the suttas comes into being. Because these are always related to practice. And that's why they are so pragmatic, and that's why they are all about practice all the way through. And the deeper your meditation goes, the more you're going to be able to relate to the content of those suttas. So that, you're precisely right. It is the interpretation and the experience that go together, basically. And also, it's very important to have a teacher, because it's possible to have the experiences, and it's possible to read things into the suttas which may not be there. So you really also need a teacher, I would say. So you have those three things. You have your own experience, you have the suttas, and then you have somebody who you can take as a teacher who hopefully knows more than you do. Yes, sir. What it is? Okay, well, basically enlightenment in Theravada Buddhism is the destruction of greed, hatred and delusion. So in other words, it's taking out what sometimes is called the three poisons of the mind. The ending, another way of putting it is an ending of all suffering here. Make rid of all suffering here. That's what enlightenment is all about. Enlightenment is the whole purpose of the path of Buddhism is to get rid of suffering and increase in your own happiness. Enlightenment is the highest possible happiness, says the Buddha.
And is it escape from psychic existence?
Oh, yes, yeah, yes, precisely. Yeah. Yes, yeah, it certainly does, because the whole problem with the cycle of existence is that basically there's a lot of suffering in there. So, you know, if you want to get rid of suffering, you have to get rid of this whole cycle of existence. Yeah.
And that's through what realizing
self isn't. That's part of it. That's quite right. Yeah. No inherent existence. That's what self is about. Do I believe in it? No, I being a Buddhist, I certainly don't believe in it. If I believed in it, I couldn't read it. I would have a hard time being a monk, I think. Yeah. I think Ajahn Brahm would kick me out of the monastery if I said, Ajahn, I believe in the soul. I would have big problems, I think, in that case. No, I don't believe in it. But you remember that belief in Buddhism is different from belief in many other religions. In most religions, belief doesn't actually mean belief. It means like an absolute conviction about something. Yeah. If you ask somebody about God and they say, I believe in God, it doesn't mean maybe he exists, maybe he doesn't. It means, yes, I'm sure he exists, right? In Buddhism, belief is a bit different. It means more like, well, okay, I don't believe in a self in the sense that since the Buddha taught this and I have a lot of faith in the Buddha, I take it as a working hypothesis that there is no self, there is no soul. And then that working hypothesis, I'm going to work with that and then see what happens. And when I get there for myself, well, then I will find out, right? And this, is, I think, is a skillful way of taking on any view in life, Buddhist view. You read the suttas, and the Buddha said, well, this is right view. And you say, I can't accept that. And you don't have to, because what you can do instead is neither reject it nor accept it. Just sort of leave it unresolved, if you like. But say, okay, I'm going to use it as a working hypothesis. I realize the Buddha was a very wise person. I can see that from all the discourses he said. So, because of that, at least I'm going to use it as a working hypothesis. So that, I think, is the best way of looking at belief and view in the Buddhist context, rather than as an absolute, which we have to, you know, grasp onto with certainty. Omniscient mind, well, it depends what you mean by omniscient, right? Now, if omniscient means actually really knowing and seeing everything, then there's no room for that in Theravada Buddhism. Anybody else want to ask something? Yes, Sukha. Well, this is another part of Buddhist history which I didn't really touch on at all, and this is to what extent and when they were actually written down. The first writing down of the suttas happened about 100 BC. So there was a long period from the Buddha passed away until they were written down, basically, about 400 years. And during this period, it was just passed on as an oral transmission. So that may be a reason why there has been some, faults or mistakes done over those 400 years, because of the oral transmission is liable maybe to some mistakes. But I find it still remarkable that considering that this is an oral transmission, and of course the ancient Indians were masters of oral transmission, because everything was actually transmitted orally in those days. It's amazing that it was for 400 years in the Theravada tradition, even longer in some of the other traditions, and yet the mistakes are so few. So the first writing down happened in Sri Lanka about 100 BC, basically. That's when it happened. Before then, it was oral transmission. Is that what you wanted to know? Yes? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Does anybody else want to say anything? Yeah. Gina. Okay.
Since you're so willing to answer all these stuff.
It's only 9 o'clock. Yeah. Uh-huh. You're getting a bit outside the scope of what I must admit that what I know anything about. The medicine Buddha, I think, is a Mahayana concept, a Bodhisattva concept in Mahayana, who is supposed to, some way to, you know, to help beings, to cure them of sickness and that sort of thing. Yeah. I think that's what it is. It's a Mahayana concept, Bodhisattva idea, but I don't really know very much about it. So I think there's a Buddhist dictionary in libraries. Look up on the medicine Buddha. You probably find out what it means. Okay. So if that's it, maybe we'll just close off and pay our respects to the Triple Gem.
Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho